So, welcome to our midweek podcast, and this week I'm joined by Red Pill Junkie.
Hello.
And for the first time, Adam Go Rightly.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. And we had decided, I've had a few requests for it, and Red Pill and I have been talking for a while about doing a show on Carlos Castaneda, so we figured you were the perfect person to ask to join us, Adam.
Perhaps, yeah. we'll see.
Why don't you give people who are not familiar with you a little of your background?
Oh, boy. When I got interested in strange stuff, kind of dates back to when I discovered Castaneda. I was in the 70s. I was in my teens, you know, so that was the prime period when Castaneda became known. And I was thinking about this earlier today. You know, I was interested in the counterculture and the occult and all that stuff back in my early teens, and you know, the psychedelic movement and stuff that had come out of the 60s, kind of as the 70s took a more new agey bent. And as the two series of books, you know, if you were into that scene back in the day, were they were the Lord of the Rings, Tolkien's book, and the Carlos Castaneda series of books. And so, yeah, they were kind of a revelation for a lot of people back then. And if you were ahead back in the day, and those were the books a lot of people were tuned into. So, that's some of the things I was interested in, you know, growing up in the being in my teens in the 70s, and I've also talked on other shows quite a bit about a psychedelic UFO experience I had, and that kind of propelled me on the path of looking into paranormal conspiracies, and in the 90s writing for a lot of zines. Like, that's where I met Greg Bishop. In fact, in the mid-90s, wrote a rather long, ridiculously long piece on Castaneda that I think was like 10,000 words, and Greg broke it into three parts. And it's also in, I just pulled it out today, Wake Up Down There, the Excluded Middle collection, that thing I did on Castaneda in there, and was titled The Trickster of Truths. And so, yeah, working on zines and stuff in the 90s. I wrote got interested in the Manson family story and a lot of the conspiracies revolving around that. And that resulted in the first book I wrote, The Shadow Over Santa Susana, on the Manson family. Then have done a number of things since then. Then on a book on James Shelby Downard, and quite a bit of stuff on the Discordian Society and Robert Anton Wilson. And so, yeah, that's kind of where I'm at.
Nice. Nice. All right. And Red Pill, why don't you tell us how you got into Carlos Castaneda?
Well, here in Mexico, there's a long series of esoteric magazines that have had a very long run, and that I was very fond of reading since I won't say my early childhood, but at least since my early teens, you know, Spanish published magazines, and I say Spanish is because they were published in Spain, these were magazines like Año Cero, Más Allá, Espacio y Tiempo. So it's funny how here in Mexico we kind of receive that these kinds of influence from across the Atlantic, instead of like the magazines that you guys were probably reading back in the day that were published in the United States. So getting back on track here, in those kind of esoteric Spanish magazines, the name of Castaneda was mentioned quite oftenly. And that really spurred my interest and say, okay, what is this about this guy, Carlos Castaneda? And then when I got in college, I think I talked about that with a friend of mine who had read his books, so that even sparked my curiosity even further. So I remember once going to the library. I guess I was looking for information for to do a homework or something. But then, after I had finished that, I decided to see if by any chance there were any books from Castañeda in our library. And what do you know? I actually managed to find his very first one, The Teachings of Don Juan. It was an English-speaking edition. So I took that home, and I was really hooked. I don't know why the material had a heavy resonance on me. So I ended up reading the first books, that, what I consider his tetralogy, you know, his first books, which are Teachings of Don Juan, A Separate Reality, Journey to Aztlan, and Tales of Power. And, you know, it was really like a really long story broken down into four different books that were written, I think there was a span difference of a couple of years or something, perhaps between one and the other. And then in 1999, like many other people, I went to the movies and I saw this sci-fi movie by the Wachowski brothers called The Matrix. And The Matrix really blew my mind. And I think the reason why it has such a big impact in it is because I saw a whole lot of correlations and similarities between Castañeda's philosophy and the movie. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, Neo, portrayed by Keanu Reeves, was like Carlos, you know, this young apprentice that finds this elderly teacher. In the books is Don Juan, this Yaqui brujo, you know, this shaman that from northern Mexico. And in the movie, of course, is Morpheus. And Morpheus gives Neo the famous red pill that obviously I took it then as my nom de plume. And because I found such a similarity between the red pill in the movie and the peyote that Don Juan gave to Carlos at the beginning of his apprenticeship, you know. And this idea of using these psychedelic substances, or in the Matrix case, the red pill, in order to break down reality, you know, to wake people up from this dream world we are inhabiting, and to let them see the real nature of reality. And you guys remember by the end of the movie, and I don't know if I should say spoiler right here because it's a movie that is so old, but by the end of the movie, Neo sees the agents and the rest of the Matrix as these like lines of information. And that is also very similar of what the ultimate goal of Don Juan's practice was, to see the universe as lines of energy and to see the human being as a glowing egg.
So
because of that is that I got such a confirmation from seeing, okay, so at least somebody else found this material just as interesting as I did, you know, and maybe that's the reason why I decided to name myself the Red Bull Junkie.
Oh, nice. Hundreds of thousands of people in the U.S. back, you know, there's a lot of folks in the counterculture and interested in psychedelics. He was huge, you know, back during the period in the early to mid 70s. I mean, he made the cover of Time magazine and just was incredibly successful. And he had the stamp of academia with his first book. It was published from UCLA and endorsed by academia there. And so when this book showed up, it was like, wow, this is the real deal, you know. And it even came across, there's like an appendix in the back that really gets, it's really rather dry part of the book. But So all of it had this stamp of authenticity to it, you know. That's another thing that attracted a lot of people to it during that period. Plus, Castaneda was this very charismatic, mysterious figure, much like Don Juan, it seems. And as by about 1972, he'd basically kind of become quite the recluse, and there's very few photos of him. You can find a few on the web. So that kind of added to the intrigue, the mystique of this guy, Carlos Castaneda.
And I mean, Simon & Schuster, I mean, it was a bestseller for them. Like, I think the first four, at least, were.
Yeah, the first edition of the book was through UCLA Press, whatever the name was. I think Simon & Schuster picked it up, and they republished that first edition, then the first book, and then the subsequent books. And he made a lot of money. It sold very well and continues to sell quite well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, what was the figure I saw? It sold a ton. Just like every year, it's still, all the books still sell a decent amount. They've never been out of print.
Yeah, and that article we were talking about before we came on air, it's from like Salon in 2007. I think the figure was around 7,000 every year, which is still quite a bit for books that were written, you know, 30 plus years ago.
Well, that and all the other stuff that's come out about Castaneda, which we'll get to. Mm-hmm. And my first introduction to Castaneda was sometime in the 80s. A friend of mine who was really into psychedelics and stuff had lent me the book and said, oh, you got to read this. And I read it, and I was not impressed. I didn't really like his stuff. I thought I felt like it was fictional, and I kind of dismissed it. But then bits of it stuck with me. And so even though I had dismissed it, I was kind of like, well, you know, that was kind of interesting, and that was kind of interesting. And then I picked up a few of his books and read through them, and I'm like, you know, I don't know if this is true or not, but some of this stuff works. And that was kind of the thing. Like, it didn't matter so much to me whether these stories were literally true. He, you know, and I mean, we know now that he picked up a lot of this stuff from other genuine teaching systems.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And kind of morphed it all together. So that makes sense that's why some of this stuff works so well, because it was, you know, from real wisdom teachings.
Yeah, he took a lot of Eastern mysticism, Western occultism, New Age ideas, and kind of repackaged them. Or, you know, Red Pill was talking about some of the stuff. Like, I was kind of refamiliarizing myself with Castaneda today, and he had these things about erasing personal history and stopping the world. And it was kind of renaming, you know, what happens in meditation with stopping thought. And erasing personal history is like the ego loss thing. And it kind of ties in a lot of this thinking to what happened later on down the line, when we can get to that later, you know, a little bit later if you want, where he kind of had a cult grow around him.
The two things that I always felt had a lot of power behind them were the idea of petty tyrants and how to deal with them, as well as just how much self-importance plays into everything and how to eliminate that sense of self-importance.
I've always considered Castaneda's work, and interesting, now the listeners will hear like three different versions to spell his name. But getting back to it, I see it first and foremost as a Gnostic philosophy. You know, the idea that is obviously harkens back to thousands of years, and also that had a huge influence in the early years of Christianity. The idea that the world, the material world, is like a prison that was built by this evil entity that, like, overtook or replaced the figure of the real God, and in the case of Castaneda, and also this a similarity with the Matrix, this idea that this prison was created for the benefit of these entities that predate prey on humans, you know, that they feed on us, they feed on our emotions, our fears, our angers, and that's why they want us to keep us in prison, and they don't want us to learn the truth about the real world, which is what in Castañeda's philosophy, that's the real, the ultimate goal of the shamans, of men of knowledge, as they are called in the books, is the idea of trying to get out of this system and to attain what they call as complete freedom.
Yeah. And he had that concept that most people are, was it a dragon that would eat them in death?
The eagle.
The eagle. Okay, right. I think the dragon is in Chinese philosophy. There's a similar type of concept.
Yep.
But yeah, the eagle would eat them. But if you were a sorcerer, you could avoid being eaten and therefore have that sort of eternal life where you're not stuck back into the system again. And that you find, too, in a lot of black magic type of teachings where they're like, you know, you have to follow these teachings in order not to be stuck in this cycle anymore and so on and so forth.
Yeah, part of what I got from it, and once again, I was refamiliarizing myself with some of the material. It's in the book, perhaps it was Tales of Power, where he, Carlos gets beyond that fear where he can free himself and be able to see and become a man of knowledge when he jumps off the cliff into the abyss, which, you know, is obviously that connects to Western occultism, crossing the abyss. He knew all this in, you know, those books. And what he was also was a hell of a novelist. Harlan Ellison pointed that out years ago, which I found really interesting because Harlan Ellison is a pretty strong skeptic and is, you know, the first to call bullshit on a lot of paranormal stuff, and that he was so admiring of Carlos Castaneda, I found it was quite kind of surprised me. But if you look at those books, they are, especially the early ones, are masterpieces. Some of the characters, the story, it's the stuff that sucks you into it. I think now I haven't thought about for years the character, not only of Don Juan, but Don Gennaro. He was like the ultimate trickster, doing all these crazy things. It's wild story. I think as they progressed, you know, the books became more and more far out, you know, so pulling people along. How much you going to accept about this? And I think as they progressed, they weren't as profound to me. I think they started to get watered down. I even heard, you know, and I don't know if these rumors are true, but some of the later books were kind of ghostwritten by other people. And I can see that in them. His voice is very strong in the early books, and afterwards, not so much to me. But once again, it's been years since I've read a lot of those.
Yeah, I also think that after the first four, and I don't claim to have read all of them, you know, just it's interesting, like trying to find them wasn't that easy, you know, but then every so often I will, one of those books will, you know, erupt into my life, you know, almost like it was something that I needed to read at that moment. But yeah, getting back to it, as we get introduced to more and more characters and situations, you know, the thing gets too convoluted. And what's interesting is that the idea is that Carlos is trying to reconstruct all these events that according to the story, happened to him while he was in the company of Don Juan's circle. But all this while he was in what he called the second attention. So this was a different level of consciousness in which he was interacting with all these people and he was having all these crazy adventures. But he completely forgets, you know. In the books, there's always this idea of Don Juan getting behind Carlos and wham, giving him a huge whack in the middle of his back, you know, in the solar plexus, and that's how he managed to shift his attention, you know, to this special level of consciousness in which he was ready to take in these deep lessons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what do you make of that, Adam? The strike to the back.
He's giving a whack to the Kundalini going on there.
Yeah,
could
yeah.
be. I've heard you talk about that before, and I had kind of similar Kundalini experiences. At least I think they're connected to that, as well as astral projection. So that's, you know, the Castaneda books got into a lot of that realm too. Once again, the language was different. He's not calling things astral projection or Kundalini or anything, you know, that was in the popular culture then. He was coming up with these terms that he claimed came from the shamans he studied under, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps, but you know, at the end of the day, it looks like on some level, you know, while there's a lot of truth in this, that's why I called the article I wrote back when called The Trickster of Truths, that it was all made up, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And it sets him apart in some ways because of that, because he had such a deep, profound effect. The stuff he is supposedly teaching works in a lot of levels.
Oh, yeah.
But it was all fiction.
And even still, though he had debunkers coming out in the 70s, the first was Joyce Carol Oates, who I think replied to the Time magazine article. Then in 76 or so, Richard DeMille came out with a couple of books that pretty exhaustively point out all the consistencies in the different books by Castaneda. And so, you know, as you're into the mid to late 70s, there's been all this material questioning him, but he still continued to become was still a popular force back then, and people were still, reading his books and looking to him as like a guru of some type of movement, New Age psychedelic movement, mm-hmm. even mm-hmm. though, and... But I guess by the second or third book, he kind of, Don Juan had told him, you didn't need the drugs anymore, you know?
Yeah,
that door had been open for you.
Yeah.
I think that's the end of the third book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that at the beginning of the fourth book is when he goes to Don Juan and says, hey, Don Juan, why did you force me to take all these power plants at the beginning of the apprenticeship? And Don Juan answers, because you're an idiot. Because your energetic body needed such a jolt that there is no other resort, or maybe, you know, no quicker resort than using the power plants. And that probably was, maybe it was in reaction to the fact that, you know, Carl Castaneda knew that psychedelics were starting to become less popular in the culture, mm-hmm. and maybe saying, okay, so if I want to keep my readership, I need to come mm-hmm. up with other stuff that won't get them arrested.
Yeah. Never good to have your readership arrested.
And yeah. That Don Juan character was always great at popping Carlos's bubble, you know, like when he got the first book published and took it to Don Juan supposedly and was all proud of it, and Don Juan said the only thing I'd do with that is wipe my ass with it, you know. Which is kind of like the Zen teacher that tells you exactly what you don't expect to hear, and when you first hear it, it's like, that makes no sense, or that's very insulting. And the later he thinks about it, and it's another aha moment with a lot of the inscrutable things Don Juan told him along the way that later, I guess, made some type of sense to him.
Yeah.
You know, at the beginning of our conversation, Adam, you said that the counterculture movement had two really big books that were like spurring the whole movement. And one of them was aside from the Castañeda's book, was Lord of the Rings. Now I'm wondering if young readers thought of Don Juan as a real-life Native American version of Gandalf.
Oh, of course we did, yeah. There was nothing to tell us he wasn't, you know. Once again, it had that first book had the stamp of academia on it, and we, you know, everybody wanted to believe in it anyway. So, yeah, for sure. And, I mean, especially you're in your mid-teens or so, you're more willing to buy into something like that. Hey, why not? It was fun, you know.
Yeah, and I had read those first four books, and I was fairly impressed, and still thinking that it seemed fictional, but like I said, it worked. The stuff made sense. And yeah. Then I picked up, I think, the fifth book because, you know, around here, especially in the 80s and 90s, they were in used bookshops everywhere a buck here and there because they were bestsellers. And I read the first book of the second four and just was completely unimpressed with it. I thought, well,
I think I was too at the time. I remember that. I was totally turned off. It was like,
It almost seems like after the fourth book, he like ended it, like ending a story, and then said, oh, people want more. Let's make more to the story. And I was kind of like, what's happening here?
Yeah, kind of similar to what happens to contactees, you know? I mean, they have this core story that may have a kernel of truth, you know, but then the contact probably ends. And people are still hungry for more, so they have no other option but to start faking, you know, the contact and start hoaxing photos.
Yeah, I was thinking of this today about parallels, and with Castaneda, supposedly, according to, I think this was in the book written about him by his first wife. Her name was Margaret Runyon. I think that's where I read this, where in the late 50s, he's working on a fictional thing about a Don Juan type character. Mm-hmm. And you can find more material about in that book by her. The name escapes me. And it kind of reminded me, it was a parallel to George Adamski, how in the late 40s, he had basically, you know, prior to the whole Orthon hookup, he had written this fictional account that pretty much mirrored his later so-called experience. Mm-hmm. It was a fictional title called Pioneers of Space, I think, and he sent it to Ray Palmer at Fate Magazine. It got rejected, and of course, later years, skeptics and whatnot discovered this and went, oh, aha, he's already cooking up this thing, you know, several years in advance.
Yeah, yeah. I had the name of that book right in front of me, and I don't know where it went.
Which book's that?
The one his ex-wife wrote.
Yeah.
It actually sounds like the name of one of his books. Or it sounds like something he would have written.
It's well worth reading all the books of that nature on Castaneda, the Richard DeMille books, if you can find those, and Margaret Runyon's book, I think that's her name, and also the one that came out a little later than those by Amy Wallace, which is really quite revealing, and that's called The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yeah, that's sitting right in front of me right here. And that's not the book, the name of it, just as you were saying that.
Yeah, and that,
I'm looking at the name of the other one there.
And that tells the story how she was, by her own account, manipulated and abused to a certain extent. We're talking about mental abuse by Castaneda, which is similar to some of the stories that Richard DeMille had heard back in the 70s. There was one account in one of his books. Gosh, you know, and this is pulling this out of my brain. It's been 15 years or so since I read this stuff, but it was an account where Carlos hooked up with some young lady, and she was going to be his apprentice, and so you know, going along quite well, quite charmed by Castaneda. Apparently he was a very charming, charismatic guy, and at some point he came back he'd been gone for a couple weeks. She's wondering what happened to him, and he looked very agitated, and he said he'd met with Don Juan and that she had to get rid of her dog and all this other stuff. And it was evident that he was, you know, playing games with people, or he might have been a little mentally. Who knows what was going on. I think it's even possible that there was a bit of a sociopath in Mr. Castaneda. I know a lot of people don't want to hear that, but perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like he hit a home run with this book.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, other than to make money and get his name out there, he didn't necessarily do anything horrible starting off. I mean, there's nothing, you know, other than maybe the fact that he pushed this as a factual account when it was fiction.
Yeah.
But the stuff in the book is very positive. It's not stuff that's going to hurt people, and you know.
Yeah.
And like I said, it works. The stuff is effective if used properly. I mean, it because he took it from legitimate wisdom traditions, mm-hmm. and such.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like at a point he realized, you know, he was it. And that's when he started becoming that cult leader sort of personality.
Yeah.
You know, the power went to his head because, I mean, even early on, people said that he was incredibly charismatic. He was the type of person that he didn't even have to talk to you and you liked him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed.
You know, he just had that vibe to him.
Yeah, and why the change came about, who knows. You know, I hadn't heard about Castaneda for years, and I got interested in him in the mid-90s, and that's when I wrote that long article, and that's when I became aware that he had kind of reemerged in Los Angeles there, and he'd had this group form around him, and they were having, like, public workshops for or performances, rituals, I'm not sure what you'd call it, for a technique called...
Yeah, they called it magic passes.
Yeah, and magic passes. The group, they also called it, what you just said, it
Tensegrating. Yeah.
Tensegrating,
which is actually a word that was coined by this great architect, Buckminster Fuller.
Yeah.
So this was a little bit prior to his death, and I started seeing some of this material, and you can see the photos now. He had these young ladies, most of them... you know, had cut their hair short, and you see them at these workshops and kind of martial art looking, performing these different magical passes and stuff. And as you learn more, most of these women had changed their names, and there was a small group that lived with Castaneda there in Los Angeles. And so as I was discovering this stuff, this was, you know, mid to late 90s, and then in 98 he passed on, and that's when the story got even a little bit more bizarre.
Yeah, I actually read the two books written by those two women in his inner circle, Florinda Donner-Grau, I think was,
mm-hmm.
and Taisha Blarth. And it was kind of weird because it was like, reading the same story from a completely different point of view. In fact, they give Don Juan and Carlos different names. Like they claim that they didn't know the real names until after, you know, they were further advanced in the apprenticeship. And it was, they also have ventures with Don Genaro and all these other groups of brujos who were part of Don Juan's group of brujos, the ones who, according to Carlos Castaneda's main story, managed to break free and became, like, I don't know, immortal beings or whatever. And supposedly Carlos was going to be the new Nahual. That's the name of the leader.
Yeah.
The new Nahual for this other new group that Don Juan was forming around him. And these women were all part of him. There also was a woman by the name of Carol Teeks,
yep.
who was like the La Mujer Nahual, like a woman who had like the same level of energetic power as he had. And they were supposed to be the new leaders of this group, but apparently something went wrong. You know, Carlos wasn't able to do it. And the way he explained it is because in the end he didn't have the the necessary like energetic reservoirs or something that will and enable them to pull the feet of the breaking free from reality. And that's why, you know, he kind of like decided not to follow in Don Juan's footsteps and to start to give away these, you know, secret magic passes that supposedly had been created since the time of the ancient Toltecs, thousands and thousands of years ago. So this story is that they had this great civilization of wizards that ruled over Mexico before any of the sanctioned, you know, cultures in Mesoamerica. And that's why he came up with this clear green organization and selling up all these videos, you know, to train people in these magic passes.
The magical passes, once again, it seems like he was borrowing from other things, are very much like Tai Chi, you know?
Yeah.
Tapping into the Chi force. And, yeah, I'm glad you're here, Red Pill, to pronunciate everything like the Nagal. I always thought the Nagal and whatever.
And the thing is, the lore he created also said that sorcerers didn't get sick.
Oh yeah.
And so there was one woman who got kicked out of the group because she had gotten sick with something, and they tried to hide it. And as soon as he found out, he kicked her out of the group. And then when he got sick, they tried to cover that up because obviously he couldn't be the man of power he was and be sick.
Right.
Yeah.
Because he died of cancer, didn't he?
Yeah.
I believe so, yeah. And, you know, who knows what was going on with the inner circle, but apparently that, you know, there's a couple of versions that probably upset those ladies that, you know, he could actually get sick and died. And but then the popular spin they were putting on it was that he'd gone off to whatever the... whatever that mystic land is that shamans go and the women were going to join him there. And shortly afterward, they all disappeared and the suspicion was they all offed themselves. One of the folks in his group, I think the name was Patricia Parton, was found in Death Valley. Yeah. And they haven't found, as far as the rest of the women, I don't think they've ever... found what happened to any of them.
Although at the same time, apparently no one ever looked for them because they had cut ties with their families and, you know, erased their past.
Yeah.
So when they went missing, nobody cared. I mean, because nobody, they weren't connected to anyone.
Yeah.
That's a good point. And there was, at that time that was going on, I was part of a, seemed like an email group, somebody who was associated with, what was it called?
Clear Green.
Clear Green, yeah. And there was a lot of questions about who was in charge of the Clear Green estate. And I never followed up on any of that, but it was a very strange situation.
Mm-hmm. And he had died of liver cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But
Which completely ruined these... legend or image of him as being an impeccable man of knowledge because Don Juan supposedly, you really never get to know how old is he, but he's this man who looks like he's like 70 years old, but he can perform feats that not even a 20-year-old can do. And the way they hear the story, he's just at least 100 years old, right?
You know, yeah.
Along with Don Genaro. Completely was running contrary to this the you know the magic of the story.
And according to the Salon article, the media didn't learn of Castaneda's death for 2 months. When the news became public, Clear Green members stopped answering their phones. They soon placed a statement, which Jennings says was written by Wagner, on their website, and it said, "For Don Juan, The warrior was a being who embarks when the time comes on a definitive journey of awareness, crossing over to total freedom. Warriors can keep their awareness, which is ordinarily relinquished at the moment of dying. At the moment of crossing, the body is, in its entirety, is kindled with knowledge. Carlos Castaneda left the world the same way as his teacher Don Juan Matas did, with full awareness. And it said obituaries had a curious tone where the writers seemed uncertain whether to call Castaneda a fraud or not.
they probably didn't know whether to believe that statement or, you know.
Well, there's that too.
Or maybe they didn't know how powerful Clear Green was or whether they were going to be sued.
Well, true.
It sounds similar to Scientology when L. Ron Hubbard died.
Oh, yes.
Once again, people of that stature die and you got a pretty big estate, you know, there becomes a lot of behind the scenes stuff going on that we'll never hear about.
And it says Castaneda's will, which was executed 3 days before his death, leaves everything to an entity known as Eagle's Trust.
Okay, yeah, that's coming back to me. That was the questions about the estate, because people who were looking into this stuff and were even kind of involved with the Castaneda group didn't know who this entity was. What was it? Eagle's
Trust.
Yeah, they weren't sure who was running the estate or the trust at that point. As I recall, this has been a number of years.
Yeah, and it's, it's such a clear-cut cult at a certain point, and it's so easy to kind of twist these rather positive teachings into a control factor for this cult.
The thing that struck me, there's a lot of things, obviously, that point to a cult, the changing of names, you can see that happen in all these groups like the Manson family, not saying these folks were murderers, but it's that whole erasing the past where, Castaneda or Manson or whoever, L. Ron Hubbard, becomes the central figure in everybody's life. His children, basically, and he names them. And they become his lovers and family and,
Yeah, because at the beginning of the apprenticeship, there's the idea that the man of knowledge needs to really have to store their in precious energetic reservoir, and that you lose that when you engage in sexual intercourse. But then at some point, Carlos said, no, Actually, Nahuales are exempt of that, So, so it's okay if I, fool around with you guys, You shouldn't do that, but with me it's okay.
Yeah, it happens to all guru. Well, a lot of them. Yeah,
and it's really unfortunate when you look at this stuff and the stuff he did to some of these women and some of these people in the group. They were talking about how he would pull other people back in even though they didn't want to return because he was just so good at this.
Yeah.
This whatever it was he was doing.
Well, in the philosophy, it's called stalking. Apparently, men of knowledge could either become dreamers, people who perfect the act of dreaming, entering to these alternative worlds through dream time. And there was these others who were the stalkers, who were using, psychological manipulation, you can call it, in order to achieve their goals and in order to fool people.
Yeah.
Like tricksters.
It says in talking, and again in the Salon article, this woman, Cadium, was talking about, it said, she was devastated when Castaneda banished her from the Sunday sessions, telling her, the spirit spit you out.
Ouch.
And she said she eventually recovered and now remembers this as the most exciting time of her life.
Mm-hmm.
According to all who knew him, Castaneda was not only mesmerizing, he also had a great sense of humor. It's not even, it was definitely a cult, But the even when he damaged these people, they still didn't necessarily look back on it and be like, "Oh, I'm so glad I'm out of that."
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
They were saying about basically he freed them up from making decisions. Wallace was the one that said that. We were free from the tedium of the world. So, but it's like it's. Yeah, it's such a difficult character to wrap your brain around.
Yeah, but maybe you shouldn't, you know? Like you said, why... I understand why people get obsessed with his figure, you know? Or even the figure of Don Juan, whether, oh... some people are still fighting whether he was completely fictional or not, or whether the character was based on some real... person. I think that read somewhere that maybe Castañeda based the character on the figure of Maria Sabina, you know, this, mm-hmm. this Mazatec woman living in Oaxaca, Mexico, who was, you know, so good at using mushrooms in order to perform her practice. But like you guys said, you know, the work, the body of work, it's a great story, but also still contains a lot of valuable stuff, yes, that you, yeah, can apply to your life, you know, even from a philosophical point of view, this idea of living an impeccable life, of trying, mm-hmm, to go about your life as if you were a warrior going into battle.
Follow a path of heart. Can't,
exactly,
go wrong with that.
Yeah, yeah, and take responsibility for your actions.
Much like Crowley's true will, you know?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's one thing got me about a lot of the books, you know, and after two or three you're wrestling with, is this, you know, all made up? But then, you know, you'd read, Red Pill had mentioned before, you know, things he would bring up in his book, like the Illuminous Egg, mm-hmm, which was basically an allusion to the orb. It was like, well, okay, maybe he's seeing the aura and a number of other things. Like he talked about power places or sitio.
Yeah.
How do you pronounce that, Red Pill? Sitio?
Un sitio, yeah.
And which was, you know, another parallel to feng shui or something like that, you know. So,
mm-hmm,
he was, mm-hmm, definitely steeped and had a pretty vast knowledge of the occult and all, you know, all these things.
Oh, he certainly did his homework. There's no two,
yeah,
ways around
sure,
about that. But it, like that quote with the human aura, DeMille quotes a passage by a mystic yogi, Rama Shakara, that says the human aura is seen by the psychic observer as a luminous cloud, egg-shaped, streaked by fine lines like stiff bristles, standing out in all directions.
Yeah. Yep.
And in a separate reality, Castañeda says a man looks like a human egg of circulating fibers, his arms and legs like luminous bristles bursting out in all directions.
Yeah,
I mean,
that when I read that line from the DeMille book, I went, oh, okay. I see what he was doing there, Castañeda.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he's taken all these different pieces from different teachings and putting them together into a story,
mm-hmm,
that works.
Yep. Yeah, apparently an inspiration, this was according to his wife, and it was around 58 or 59, they read, and she was into all this stuff with him during that period. They had both of them had an interest in the paranormal and these type of subjects, and they stumbled upon that Andrea Puharic book, The Sacred Mushroom, and she said after he read that, something happened with Carlos. He changed and he started leaving for trips to Mexico,
mm-hmm,
quite often, and when he'd return, he'd never talk about what he was doing during that period. So, mm-hmm, he was definitely out there searching for something, it seems like. What exactly he found, whether he did find a Don Juan out in the world or found Don Juan within himself is, you know, not totally clear, but yeah.
Did you guys know that Castañeda was going to make a movie with Federico Fellini?
That would have been wild.
Yeah, and apparently was going to be something about showing the Mayan ruins of Tulum and other places. And it never came to pass, but this famous Italian comics writer, I forgot his name, but he actually made a graphic novel about out of it. It's called Dream of Tulum. And in that he shows Fellini, and he also shows Castaneda.
Oh, well, that'd be an interesting collaboration there. The apparently for years and years, you know, there's been options on what was the first book again titled?
The Teachings.
The Teachings of Don Juan, of course.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I heard at one time the Anthony Quinn was slated to play the role, but yeah, it'd be interesting to interesting subject to tackle one way or another, the Don Juan story or the life of Carlos Castaneda.
Yeah, they would definitely both be interesting. I mean, if you did the story as if it were, you know, if you presented it in the story form, it would be interesting to watch, just like reading the books were interesting. Mm-hmm. But it would also be interesting if someone tried to take on Castaneda's life.
Yeah.
You know, in that sort of movie sense.
I would merge the two together, and at the end of the story, you're not clear who is who and what is what, if there was a Don Juan, and, you know, leave a little bit of mystery there, but combine, you know, both stories, Castaneda's life and Don Juan as a perhaps real character.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it would have to be a mini series, I think, at that point.
Yeah.
To get all the information in.
Sure. Yeah. Well, that seems to be the way to go now, you know, with all the interesting work. I don't say all the interesting work, but you've had these long series that have been really well done from Breaking Bad on down the line, you know. So, yeah, that would be a good format for the Castaneda Don Juan story. So, you know, same thing with Twin Peaks coming back. I hear they're slated to produce two or three seasons.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. I knew they were doing the one. I didn't know if they were doing more.
Yeah, I think I just heard they went signed for more. So whoever network he's working with apparently liked what they saw enough to chill out some more money.
I don't know if you guys remember that crazy-ass movie, Altered States.
Yeah,
which I actually happen to like, and obviously the movie is based majorly in the work of John Lilly and the sensory deprivation tanks. Mm-hmm. But there's also elements in the movie that seems to have been inspired by Castaneda's early books. I remember reading it. I think it was probably the first or the second one, how at one point of this ceremony that Don Juan was performing to create this psychedelic brew that then he gives Carlos to drink, he reaches for his arm, he grabs his hand, and without any warning, he goes and he cuts him, you know, right in the palm. And he then uses the blood that is flowing out of Carlos, poor Carlos's hand, to pour it into the brewing mix that he was cooking, and then he gives that nasty thing to Carlos to drink, and that same thing happens in the movie when the character played by John Hurt, I think is his name, goes to Mexico, you know, to try to get the secret of these magic mushrooms that are from a group of fictional tribe that I think they were kind of like portrayed as the Tarahumara in the part of Chihuahua in Mexico. But yeah, I'm curious to try now to think of other movies which might have been influenced by Castaneda's books.
Well, I'm sure there's tons because, I mean, he had such an impact on popular culture that it's almost unavoidable. I never would have made the connections with The Matrix like you did.
I never made that connection, but I can see that. One thing we were talking about, you know, were any of his books harmful? And it just brought to mind, perhaps in the was in the first or second book, you know, he's trying these different psychedelic type concoctions, and yeah. one of them contained Jimson weed. It was a mixture of some stuff, you know, and I was going, oh, that's yeah. interesting. Maybe I should look into Jimson weed, which you really don't want to mess around with. So hopefully people weren't trying a lot of Jimson weed, because you can get a real bad trip from that stuff.
Really?
Yeah. You'll lose your mind for several days, or, you know, go blind and stuff. There's some crazy cases, and Jimson weed grows wild in a lot of places.
Huh. Interesting. You know, I mean, and there's so much legitimate stuff when it comes to, you know, psychedelics and shamans and stuff like that. Do you think it did any harm when he was writing this stuff to the legitimate shamanism down there?
Maybe. I mean, I surely there were a lot of, you know, crazy hippie gringos that were trying to look for Don Juan and pestering the poor Yaquis, right, in Sonora.
Exactly, yeah. That's what I was going to say. I heard there was a lot of that going on for a certain period. And I think, you know, in some areas, people went crazy going into Mexico and pulling out peyote, you know, like it was going out of style.
They still do that.
Yeah, which isn't easy to grow back in some places, you know.
So. Yeah, unfortunately, no.
Somewhere in the Salon article, it was talking about how people were going down to and were accosting the Yaqui Indians.
Yeah.
About all this stuff, and the Yaqui Indians were like, we don't do peyote.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's one of the things his critics pointed out. It's like, no, this doesn't really match up to any Yaqui Indians, you know.
Yeah, which is a problem, because the subtitle of the first book is
A Yaqui Way of Knowledge. Yeah.
I mean, I guess if Don Juan was an actual person that he was getting this from, Don Juan could have lied or had been a Yaqui Indian who went a different way with it.
Mm-hmm. Or Castaneda wanted to conceal the actual person or tribe, you know, he was actually dealing with. So he came up, used Yaqui instead of giving away, you know, what tribe or whatever Don Juan was actually with to protect him. Because if we believe in Don Juan didn't want a bunch of people coming around. He chose who were going to be his apprentices.
Yeah, and
it says
the idea is that in the end, Don Juan tells Carlos that his knowledge, the knowledge of his lineage of men of knowledge, really doesn't stem from the Yaquis. It stems from the ancient Toltecs.
Mm-hmm.
It says J.T. Fikes, author of Carlos Castaneda. I'm sure it's Carlos Castaneda. or actually, Miguel is I'm probably saying it correctly. academic opportunist in the psychedelic 60s believes Castaneda did have some contact with Native Americans. But he's an even fiercer critic than DeMille, condemning Castaneda for the effect his stories have had on Native peoples. Following the publication of the teachings, thousands of pilgrims descended on Yaqui territory. When they discovered that the Yaqui don't use peyote, but that the Huicholes. Okay, people do, they headed to their homeland in southern Mexico, where, according to Fikes, they caused serious disruption. Fikes recounts with outrage the story of one elder being murdered by a stoned gringo.
Jesus.
Great, yeah. Now, I have that book, too. It's been years since I've read it. Another complaint was that when Carlos was at UCLA as an anthropology student, he knew some of the folks that were looking into this type of research who were traveling to Mexico and working with shamans. And Carlos had access to a lot of their field notes and materials. One of them was Peter First, F-U-R-S-T, and he's written a couple of books, and they felt that, you know, he'd kind of ripped off their or borrowed liberally from their field notes, attributing them to himself. So yeah, if I was one of those student anthropologists, I wouldn't be too happy.
but at the same time, can you blame him for what other people do? in that sense. Like, no. Like not so much the stealing, but for people going down there and accosting these people, that's not necessarily his fault. People should, A, be responsible for their own actions, and B, know better.
If the people are going to do that, if it wasn't Castaneda, it was some other thing that would...
Yeah, I mean, so it's...
Stupid people are going to do stupid stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Looking for enlightenment.
I'm sounding like an elitist here. There are...
So, I mean, to me, a lot of this, like any of these teachings, to me, you take the stuff that works and you leave the rest of it. I don't believe in wholly following anything. You know, I really like Crowley's work, but I don't, you know, go. I'm not a Crowleyite. I think some of his stuff works. It works for me, and I think everyone's a little bit different. Some of Castaneda's stuff works great for me. I don't know if it will for other people. Obviously, it has for plenty of people.
Yeah.
But I think everyone needs, you know, I think it's fair to look at the stuff and pick what works for you and leave the rest. You don't have to go all the way in, you know?
One of the things it just did for a group of people, heads I was running around with back in the day and reading this stuff, just generated some great conversations about, you know, the Castaneda books and other philosophers and whatnot. We were into that, you know, just made us think. You know, there was always in the back of our mind is, you know, this is a real story or not. But then, you know, you talk about certain aspects of it. And so it was Castaneda was kind of a gateway drug or that got people into a lot of these ideas.
Yeah, and I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I sure know that. Because of his books, that I decided to try to see if I could achieve.
I was doing that. In fact, that's one of the things for sure. I hadn't thought of that, but I had some success lucid dreaming.
Yeah,
and one of Castaneda's, however we want to pronounce his name, one of his things with when you feel you're going into the lucid state to try to. Maintain that state is you hold out your hands and look at them.
Yeah.
And I actually...
And that works.
Well, it's for a while. Then I remember doing it this one time and it's like, oh, now my hands are getting really weird. And I was gone from the lucid state. I'm serious.
Yeah.
No, that definitely worked for me. I mean, you know... If you can train yourself to, and I think it would work with anything. It doesn't have to be your hands. Your hands are just an easy target.
Yeah.
At the same time, you could say, look at your feet. Oh, because once you have that deliberate intention in the dream can then become lucid.
So that was the point of Castaneda. It could be the hands. It could be whatever. Yeah.
Yes. But that's the thing. This stuff does work. So take it as it is. And... It's unfortunate that it all kind of... I mean, some of it sounds like the Heaven's Gate cult near the end.
Yeah.
You know, and getting back to this idea of maybe one of the reasons why he chose to keep the people second-guessing about whether it was all true or not, of whether how much of it was fiction, how much of it wasn't. Maybe there's something about that, about... leaving people in that level of uncertainty that manages to trigger the magic, for lack of a better term. You know, I'm thinking right now of crop circle artists. You know, I think the crop circle artists know that if you go to a person and say, you know what, I did that crop circle, I'm going to show it, prove it to you beyond any question that I did that circle. They don't do that because... they want to keep people still with the wonder, not because they want to. I don't think because they want to fool people and say, "Ha ha, those gullible crop circle believers," but because they know that it's kind of like the placebo effect, if you know what I mean. It's like keeping that level of belief in people, that which manages to trigger something within our minds. That opens up to something that is quite real, even if the origin of it happens to be fictional.
Not only that, but people who make these crop circles have had so many unusual experiences themselves.
Well, yeah. And who knows, you know, if Castañeda himself also ended up having weird experiences that he couldn't account for.
I bet. And to be fair to Castañeda, what do we know about him other than what we've read about him? It's like, I'm sure a lot of it's true, but it's like, you know, the mystique that grew around Aleister Crowley, you know, a lot of that was just a bunch of myths and things his enemies made up about him. So, yeah, we'll never really know the truth. We just get bits and pieces of it. I do know somebody who ran across Castañeda. It must have been on the campus of UCLA years and years ago. And they didn't really talk, but they just passed by, and he looked in his eyes, and this guy told me, yeah, there's really something special and intense about the look of the guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, people said he was incredibly charismatic just being around him. It wasn't that he was just, you know, manipulative and could, you know, soothe people. It was like instant, just his energy. And that happens with people.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times it happens with cult leaders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But even like the last Bush who was president apparently was very charismatic. You know, for all that people hated him, you know, people would say, you know, when they were alone with him, he was incredibly charismatic. He was very likable.
I've heard that, people who have met him. He's just a good old boy when it's a one-on-one situation. Yeah.
So, I mean, some people just generate that sort of very positive feeling of energy around them.
Mm-hmm.
They make you feel good and you like them.
Yeah, some people have said that the same thing about someone like the Dalai Lama. And in fact, now that Adam is here, I know that you interviewed once Chica Bruce, and you guys were discussing this idea of obscene Tibetan lamas as psychic vampires, you know?
She brought that up.
I know.
Really?
I don't remember much about it, but yeah, there was some faction of Tibetan lamas that were, kind of practicing some sort of black magic, psychic vampirism.
Yeah.
Hmm.
You can find more on the internet.
I'm sure. You can find more of everything on the internet.
Except that actual interview, because it was mysteriously erased.
Oh, yeah. Really? Okay. It's coming back to me. I've been to Tibet and heard the monks chanting. It's quite a intense, somewhat surreal experience. And I could see how you could interpret anything on your
sure
on how your brain reacts. You know, you could interpret the chanting as a wonderful thing, or an evil thing, or be indifferent to it.
And when you compare like Castañeda and Crowley, the difference too is that Crowley reveled in people making stuff up about him.
Yeah. Maybe,
you know.
Well, I get the with Castañeda, who knows? I'm sure he loved the he must have, because he cultivated this mythology around himself. So
yeah
but then he kind of removed himself.
That was part of the mystique, though.
Yeah, I guess it is. Well, anything else we've missed here, Red Pill?
I remember reading in the first book this concept of diableros, the idea of these evil shape-shifting brujos in northern Mexico. That now that I think about it, it sounds quite a lot like the concept of the skinwalker that we have heard a lot lately in paranormal circles. Interestingly enough, that those concepts no longer are repeated in the rest of the books, but I remember how that fascinated me when I first read the first one.
Yeah, and as the books progressed, it became, more evident, that it was kind of a good and evil thing going on sometimes with these people who, I forget all the stories now, wasn't there some witch that was after Don Juan, and Carlos got in the middle of this, and people were turning into wolves and different things?
Yeah, but apparently that witch was actually part of Don Juan's circle, so it was kind of like a test.
You
know, it was all a trick.
Another thing was Mezcalito, which parallels to the Green Man.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's like a nature spirit that comes out when, for instance, taking peyote, you tap into this nature vegetable green spirit. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, Robert Anton Wilson had the same experience. And this was before the Castaneda books were published in the early 60s. And Wilson writes about this in Cosmic Trigger. He started sending off for peyote and experimenting with it. Back then, yeah, you could, wherever he could send in a few bucks and get a shipment of peyote sent to you.
Yeah.
And at that same time, he was kind of living on a commune type state and doing gardening. And he was out one day, and this was like, you know, maybe the day following a peyote trip, and he saw a green man walk across his field of vision.
Interesting.
Much like Mezcalitos, as I recall, is described in those Castaneda books.
Yeah, it was an anthropomorphic peyote man, cactus man.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw that green man when it wasn't clear whether or not he was actually using the peyote at the time, was it?
It sounded like he had used the peyote a day or two before. He'd been, you know, experimenting with it quite a bit, so he was quite possibly still under some type of influence in his system, or he triggered something in his mind that allowed him to see a green man that day.
Yeah. Yeah, like Terence McKenna's vision of these Adamski-like flying saucer, you know.
Yeah.
It's not like at that moment he was eating the mushrooms, but, you know, he had been eating mushrooms like crazy with his group during months, so obviously, you know, his whole bloodstream must have been saturated.
Or like, you know, in the books where Don Juan says we don't need the drug anymore, we've opened the door.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, one part of his philosophy that I have never really understood quite well was this concept of the inorganic beings.
Hmm. I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, apparently. Yeah. I guess it was something akin to Terence McKenna's, you know, machine elves.
Were these the allies?
Well, yeah, in the end, you realize that the inorganic beings are the allies that he had mentioned on previous books. These entities that the brujos will be able to, like, ally themselves in order to carry on tasks. But these definitely were non-human entities that live separate dimension, which brujos could get into, you know, either through power plants or through, you know, other means.
See, it's funny, all these terms, the brujos and allies and all this stuff, you know, we'd be sitting around smoking a joint talking about these, all these terms that were straight out of Castaneda, you know, and they meant something to us. You could have deep discussions about it, you know. Same thing with the city. Oh, this is my power place, man. I feel good here. Yeah.
Nice. I know he also inspired. There's a fictional book called The Way of Weird that Brian Bates had written, and he took a lot of stuff from Castaneda in writing that book, as well as other like druidic, because it takes place in England. mm-hmm. when the Christian missionaries are coming across. But you can plainly see the Castaneda influence in the book as you're reading it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's been a bunch of books that seem like they've been influenced by him. What's that really popular one called The Four Agreements or something like that?
Oh, yeah. Never read those, but yeah.
It's not too bad, actually. And this guy, yeah, he claims the guy who wrote him to be some type of Toltec shaman from the lineage of Castaneda. And, you know, you can believe that as much as you want to. But the book itself has some good stuff. And it seems some of it's reminiscent of, the kind of Don Juan philosophy.
Interesting. I've not heard of that one.
Yeah, and if someone uses the term Toltec, then chances are that he was definitely influenced by Castaneda. Obviously, Toltec was an actual culture that lived in central Mexico. Not that really that long ago, but they were definitely here before the Aztecs. And Toltec, if I remember my Nahuatl correctly, means artist, you know, so that's why, you know, it was kind of like a compliment, you know, to name people using that term.
All right. Anything else?
The Four Agreements, and it says, I pulled it. Can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. I pulled up the Four Agreements just to give you the little blurb about it. It's called In the Four Agreements, Don Miguel Ruiz reveals the source of self-limiting beliefs that rob us of joy and create needless suffering. Based on ancient Toltec wisdom, the Four Agreements offer a powerful code of conduct that can rapidly transform our lives to a new experience of freedom, true happiness, and love. It was on the New York Times bestseller for 7 years. Sold 5.2 million copies. Good heavens.
You know what amazes me, though, is that you can come up, you can make something like this up, even if you're taking none of it from ancient sources, and it can work. But unless you say it comes from ancient sources, nobody's going to take it seriously.
Yeah.
Or from the, what's the records, the...
Akashic records.
What's that called? It's the Akashic records. Yes, of course. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, even the Jane Roberts Seth material. As much as I was against channeled stuff, when I read that stuff, I was like, okay, this isn't like other channeled stuff. This is actually really interesting. And she herself would say, I don't know where this is coming from. It could be coming from some part of my unconscious. I really don't know.
Oh, what if Carlos Castaneda channeled the books?
Channeled Don Juan. Met him in an alternate consciousness. But, you know, it's like the question is, if Jane Roberts had written that stuff out as her own theories on things, I don't think they would have sold. But as channeled material, people ate them up.
Yeah. Sure.
And I mean, I don't sense. I was going to say, I don't sense any deception on their part. They seem to be fairly open and straightforward, and they didn't become millionaires off of it. They didn't start a cult. Mm-hmm. I believe that she believed whatever was happening was real, even if she didn't know what it was. But like I said, if she has just written.
Yeah, I used to reach out.
Go on.
I kept stepping on you there, but I'd written to Jane Roberts back in the day. I used to reach out to some of these people, and I'd kind of forgotten about that. And I pulled out her, book called Seth Speaks. That was probably her most famous one. And I had sent a letter to her, and I got a postcard back, and I forget what year it was, but it was from her husband informing me that she had just died. There was some more information in there, but probably a year ago or so, I hadn't seen that book in 10 or 15 years. I pulled it out, and oh, God, I forgot all about this. But anyway, that's a sidebar.
I had actually tried reading, started reading A Way Toward Health, which is the last one she did as she was in the hospital, and it's hard to read.
Mm-hmm.
Not because the information is bad, but you can just feel like his heartache as she's laying there basically dying.
Yeah.
You know, there's one entry apparently he forgot about, like it just got lost, and he found it after she had died. And, you know, he's a very good writer, and when he expresses how this made him feel finding this, you're just like, wow.
Need to read that. Yeah.
Some good stuff. Yeah, I would check out Seth Speak. Something about it's one of those books that seems to resonate for some reason, you know. The early Castaneda books, or, you know, whatever you want to name. Something special about that book. I'm not sure I could could read it now again, and probably couldn't put my finger on it, but seemed like it was a true vision from her, whatever it was.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, it, you know, when I read it, I tried to debunk it.
Yeah.
Because I had such an aversion to channeling, and
yeah,
I couldn't. There's nothing that she wrote that can be flat-out debunked, and unlike other channeled entities, it's not all vagueness. It's very specific and detailed. You're like, okay, so modern science is actually supporting the stuff that she's saying or that Seth is saying. And it's like, all right, I don't know what to do with this.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
just taking it at face value at that point. It's worth something because the stuff in it works. The stuff she's talking about seems to be accurate, regardless of what the source was.
Yeah, it's interesting how some books end up resonating with you and others don't, you know. And now I'm remembering how I encountered the Castaneda's books at a very rather difficult moment in my life. You know, I was going through problems because I kept getting fired or quitting from jobs to jobs. So I was really, really unstable. I had problems with my family. Yeah, it was a rough patch in my life, and for some reason the books helped me, you know, emotionally, you know, gave me some kind of emotional stability. I don't know why, but they did.
They gave you a way to see things differently.
I guess maybe they gave me confirmation that I wasn't that crazy in assuming that this world is not really the end all be all of everything, right? Mm-hmm. And that was a huge comfort for someone like me.
And actually, I had started reading the Seth material when I was in a very severe depression. And it kind of picked me. It was the only thing that picked me out of that depression, because suddenly here was something that I literally picked up Seth Speaks thinking it would be funny to read at some point. And I had been looking, I think, through near-death experience research. And for some reason, they kept quoting Seth. And I'm like, why are all these like semi-scientific sites referencing Seth? And I dug the book out of, you know, a pile of books, and I sat down and I read it, and it was just like, wow. Okay, this is not what I expected. And it kind of lifted me out of that depression.
Yeah, the things, the books, whatever music that sticks with you, you know, I think that it's a lot of timing where you're at with in your life,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And also, you know, would these books have, you know, these books, I don't know, would have had the same impact if they came out today. But would our culture be the same, especially with like psychedelics and all this other stuff? You know, would The Secret have been a book if it wasn't for the Seth material at some point?
Well, before The Secret, there was a lot of books that led to The Secret.
Well, yeah. But a lot of them seem to stem from the Seth material. Like they're all watered down versions of Seth material.
Yeah. Oh, no, the timing for the Castaneda books, it had to be right then. At that time in the late 60s.
Yeah, like you said, you know, he was really one of the cornerstones of the counterculture movement. I mean, right along Timothy Leary and all those, Albert Hoffman and all those big names. And, you know, for some reason or other, Castaneda fell into obscurity. And I guess he's regaining some notoriety, and I actually think is a good thing, you know, provided people get enough sense of taking all this material with a grain of salt, and also not to fall into a cult situation in which people will assure them, oh yeah, you know, so-and-so is actually another apprentice of Don Juan, and he'll accept you in your circle provided you give him, you know, $10,000, something like that.
All your money, all your holdings.
All your money and it belongs to him, yeah.
All right. Well, I thank the two of you. This has been a fascinating conversation.
Yeah.
And we will have you back, Adam, as well. Obviously, Red Pill joins us regularly. Mm-hmm. Still there, Adam?
Oh, I'm sorry. I accidentally hit my mute. what you didn't hear me say was, yeah, thanks for having me on.
And I know we are planning on doing a show with Greg Bishop and you and whoever else wants to join us. I don't know if Red Pill's interested or not on...
I would love to be there just listening to you guys talk about Robert Anton Wilson.
Thank you. I can't believe I blanked out his name. So that'll be upcoming at some point in the undetermined future.
Sure.
All right. And so, yes, thank you guys. It was a great conversation.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Good talking to y'all.
Yeah, likewise. Bye-bye.